The sketch picture. When you said that.
Drug vote. Not necessarily.
Turn that on.
Okay. Good morning. There isn't much of you, sir?
Yes, there is.
The wires are warming up. Not exactly the way I'd planned it, but in perfectly reasonable fashion, nonetheless, or perhaps because it wasn't planned, I'd like to talk about three buildings today. Buildings that in retrospect, that is to say, through the rear view mirror of half a century's distance, can certainly claim to have been absolutely pioneering buildings. Buildings whose specific qualities are perhaps only fully apparent today when architecture has taken a course that could only be described as deviant from the tracks on which it had been set by the first decade after the Second World War. If you've ever asked yourself what the difference might be between a survey text and following a series of lectures like these, I have a very simple and fully documented answer for you. None of these three buildings makes an appearance in Ken Frampton's Critical History of Modern Architecture. Although the three architects are certainly not minor figures and do not go unrecognized in that survey text, which in many ways aspires to a canonic reading of 19th and 20th century architecture. But it's a good instance to recognize what particular blinkers, anybody with that ambition, which I didn't share to begin with, of writing a canonic account of modern architecture would have to put on in order to cope with the subject, and particularly to cope with what would be considered, from that particular point of view, undesirable developments. Now, it so happens that in the last 50 years, it was exactly the undesired, or in some quarters, the undesirable developments that produced particularly consequential results. And I think whatever one's difference in opinion and evaluation might be, and there certainly is ample room for differences of evaluation, for different critical points of view to be brought to these three works, I think it amounts to an act of censorship to exclude these three buildings from any treatment of architecture in the 20th century. The three buildings are Jørn Utzon's Opera House in Sydney, Australia, Le Corbusier and Yannis Xenakis's pavilion for the electronic supply firm of Philips, the Philips concern in the Netherlands, at the Brussels World's Fair of 1958. And the third is, in no particular order for that matter, because they are exactly contemporary, is Hans Scharoun's Philharmonic Hall in the city of Berlin. Now, each one of these, of course, not only due to the enormous differences in sight, in cultural conditions, in background and interests on the part of clients and architects, all of these require a separate, if not exhaustive, at least characteristic analysis. At the same time, if you add a dash of salt, they can all be located in the same category of building. They are all basically halls where people gather in order to listen to certain things, music in particular, but not only, or where they listen and view things that are happening. While the Sydney Opera House, by its very definition of purpose, is of course one of these, and the Berlin Philharmonie is another, reduced there to oral impression. The Philips Pavilion was conceived in order for the firm of Philips to not present their products as such, but to present rather the ideas that were important in the nature of the enterprise of such a vast conglomerate and the effects that could be obtained by employing the products that they produced. One would go into the Philips Pavilion and see what would be a essentially, in the French tradition, a son et lumière show, namely light and color and sounds, that would be so calibrated as to create a kind of symphonic or synesthetic impression, which lasted only a few minutes. So this is one of those moments, one of the early moments, where a firm chose in an international venue like a World's Fair not to simply exhibit its products, but make itself memorable for an experience offered to visitors to the World's Fair that is of a kind of experience, indeed anticipating some of the specific qualities which to this day characterize a modern entertainment industry, namely certain capacities to synthesize and to coordinate perfectly a variety of sensory impressions or stimuli that would be sent out to the visitors. So we are looking at what in each instance could be called to be a rather specifically defined, narrowly calculated purpose, and the underline calculated, because in order for these buildings to function appropriately, a great deal of calculation, a great deal of technical investment is necessary of every kind, not only in equipment, in fittings, but also in anticipation of the particular conditions under which the public would gather for an experience in these halls. In other words, we are at the verge of the moment when acoustics ceases to be some kind of alchemistic secret knowledge brought to a task that otherwise is defined by ever more mathematically modeled engineering. We are at the moment when acoustics indeed becomes a newly, with new means available for its study, subject of investigation. And of course, this would be, if any single quality were singled out, the defining quality of a concert hall, its acoustic properties. But it's significant that with a slightly lower importance attributed at the World's Fair to the specific location, the geography of the fair itself. It is clear that institutions of this kind, like concert halls, think of the examples that may come to mind in the United States, are typically located in very specific urban places, that their location in the geography of a town is in many ways giving away the cultural importance attributed to the activity that is housed in these buildings. For these reasons, and for perhaps others that may vary from case to case, it is not surprising that the architects at first allowed themselves a kind of intuitive exploration of what might be useful ways of thinking through the problem, rather than what might be in a more result-oriented approach, the best model, the best immediate precedent, the most promising strategy in order to arrive at the building. Rather, when I said they allowed themselves a kind of intuitive wandering through what they felt themselves to be significant in these instances, they did stray quite far from what could be said to be the standard professional attitude and the familiar ways that architects define for themselves a starting point when they have to address such an issue. This luxury, if you want, or also, in a sense, this temptation to let your own intuition seek out what could possibly be that moment or that idea, impression, feeling around which a project might finally take shape, is itself a significant phenomenon, a phenomenon which has a great future in the second half of the 20th century, when, partly fueled by criticism of the functionalist approach and certainly many extremely disappointing demonstration of what can happen if you try to square away your task strictly in terms of purpose, function, efficiency, and the like, new sources, new approaches were being explored in order to overcome some of those limitations. Surely, if there is something in store in terms of a critical experience in the decades after the Second World War, then it is that many of the well-tried and familiar recipes and many of the well-trodden paths that had been beaten before the war proved to be either too limited, too confining in nature, too limited in their results, or outright misleading. That is to say, one felt strongly that they did not produce the desired results. What happens at such a moment critically is that one widens one's scope. One looks further afield than one's colleagues or predecessors did. And we've seen this happen a number of times already. It's sufficient to remind you of the tremendous impact that the experience in Japan, for instance, had on the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. And well beyond the particular instances that you could nail down where some kind of borrowing is in fact demonstrable, but much rather that a different way of thinking of space, of sight, a different way of addressing issues of circulation, decorum, and the alike in one culture rather than in another culture than one's own, proved to be truly inspirational in the case of Wright. And you have been reminded of some of the consequences of that in the activities of the architect outside of his strictly professional domain, for instance, in the fact that Frank Lloyd Wright became the preeminent dealer in woodblock prints of Japanese origin in the United States during the 20s and 1930s.
And this not only for the difficult economic difficulties of the office, but also because he clearly was able in that area to match a profound personal interest with a welcome economic advantage. When Jørn Utzon participated in the competition for the new opera house in Sydney, he was, of course, aware, as were to varying degrees other competitors, of the fact that the opera house, to be located on the waterfront, in an area yet, in a sense, to be upgraded and to be converted from its purely geographical definition into a cultural and therefore to be integrated with the town while also projecting out into the harbour and serving as a kind of potential hallmark of the city of Sydney, he was aware that Australia sat astride between, on the one hand, an Anglo-Saxon world of its own rather controlled and controlling traditions, and on the other hand, the world of the Orient of China and Japan in particular. Therefore, it is as almost as if something wafted over, something in Utzon's own imagination arrived from the Orient. And a series of his sketches are extraordinarily interesting because they directly convey the source and the transformation of that source even before we then arrive at what could be defined the rudiments or at least an attempted solution for the project. What is interesting is that on the left-hand sketch, double roof, so well known from Chinese and Japanese houses, seems to float like a cloud over a podest, over an area that is clearly demarcated and set aside, dominated only by straight lines, whereas the roof, of course, in its hovering position, is dealing with a geometry whose complexity is proverbial for houses. In fact, it is something of a set of secret craft knowledge, elements of a secret craft knowledge that allows the construction of woods of this kind. It was originally the idea of the cloud, in his own admission, that transformed itself, or that he allowed in his imagination these clouds to take on shapes that are clearly related to clouds while ceasing to have the shape or the ingraspable nature of clouds as we know them. Of course, the roofs refer, as they do in our culture, to the sky, to what is on top. Therefore, they evoke outside both something like the top of a hill or the crest of a mountain. Remember that, because it will return in another project in significant ways. And at the same time, of course, by this reference to what is above, what is suspended, what belongs to the sky and what makes skylines, the roof also is begging for some kind of anchorage and connection to the ground. And this is exactly the element that has been left out. Had Semper, 100 years before, had Semper looked at this problem, he would have penned in the thin posts that separate, you recall, the famous Caribbean hut, itself raised on a platform, also with a very elaborate and steep roof, like a hood over the space, and then the thin posts. The posts are absent, the roof is floating, and in that sense, even though it's now undoubtedly a roof, recalls its origin in the suspended and floating nature of clouds that drift by and that, in a sense, you always see from afar. So there's another very interesting aspect, that approaching the project, that it comes down to a connection between two things which couldn't be more different one from the other. One was the here and now, the platform, the place, the spot where this building was to go, and in a sense the one element that cannot be touched or fixed, that changes shape, changes place, and anyway comes from somewhere else and is likely to glide off from the site. So in a very interesting way, it is the fixed and the transitory, it is the stable and the evanescent that are here, in a sense, momentarily challenging each other in their nature. Of course, as soon as you begin to think of this relationship in more contemporary technological terms, as soon as you begin to think of it in this way, of course you will think of some form of cupola, of some sort of shell, to put it generically, or a series of shells. And shells, of course, are nothing but the technical components of cupolas. And it is in this evolution of thinking, oh my goodness, this doesn't do much, huh? But we can see it better, perhaps, in a more advanced stage, where, in fact, the entire project is now a modified sequence of shells, one spread over the other, so as to give them a chance to mutually, as it were, link in together and lock into place. It was an extraordinarily problematic solution, which on the site required a combination of two different halls of different size, raised on a pedestal. You come from the land side over a series of steps with plazas. You reach the promontory, which was already there in the original drawing, and of course the entire place juts out to your left towards the harbour. It is here that, like a major and a minor version of the same animal, have to be linked together, and linked together through the construction of these shells. It was with the extraordinary structural problem of such a series of shells that a firm that is today a household word in engineering made its first tentative steps and came to be known for its capacity to address such unusual engineering challenges. The firm of Ove Arup, which is now active around the globe, as you know, and there's hardly anybody with any particular ambition in the area of structural engineering who would not at one time or another, or for one purpose or another, have worked in association with or the firm of Ove Arup. It is thanks to this project that the firm emerged from anonymity. Is this something I can do something about? Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Somebody else did. Let me just see. The astounding resolution of the problem is indeed due to Ove Arup. It would not have been within either the engineering capacity, also Jørn Utzon's father was a naval engineer and designer of boats, and surely that tradition, deeply rooted in the Scandinavian countries, did leave more than a minor mark on the mind of Utzon. But it was Ove Arup, the office of Ove Arup, that managed to develop the technical solution necessary for this ambitious construction, which had a number of unfortunate aspects to it initially, very few points of massive compression weight, and very wide spans and awnings of shells that nonetheless, for their own rigidity needed with the construction technology of the 1950s to be relatively heavy, therefore rendering even more dramatic the compression at certain key points. In the process of evolving the engineering solution that drew on for a process that drew on for years, there arose extraordinary controversies between the client, the municipality of Sydney, and the architect, leading to a resignation of the architect, who only very much later, when almost 40 years after construction was initiated, the building was given a thorough overhaul and renovation, that the architect was ceremoniously invited back to Sydney, back into town, in order to, in a sense, regain the share that in the final definition that had been denied him at the time of the original work. Of course, the interior presented the same classical problems that concert halls of a more conventional shape would also have presented, but they were resolved here too in a manner that should prove the proof to be extraordinarily consequential for concert halls in the later 20th century. It is no exaggeration to say that between these three structures, Sydney, the Brussels Pavilion, Le Corbusier Xenakis, and Sharoun's Philharmonie, there wouldn't be no Disney concert hall by Frank Gehry in Los Angeles, not to speak of dozens of other concert halls that have been constructed in the last 10 or 12 years around the world. Virtually none of them reverting to what had been defined before Sydney and before Berlin as the absolute de rigueur shape, as the undeniable ideal of a concert hall, what for short is known as the shoebox. It was always defined as the ideal acoustically and by implication, of course, architecturally and functionally, the most desirable shape. What has happened in the same years of these three halls, and what, if anything, influenced the experience of music and the conditioning of the public even more than the halls, of course, were the new acoustic engineering techniques, was multi-track recording, the long-playing record, the development of sensor-round sounds over various stages. All of this combined with developments in musical composition and execution helped to bring about a transformation as much of the audience as of the architecture, so that we can say we are now finally out of the box, we're liberated from the conventions that had seemed to form such a solid opposition to any changes in the concert halls that were built between the later 19th and the mid-20th century. It's astounding how uninteresting most concert halls of almost a century actually proved to be, both from an architectural point of view and with respect to acoustics, because what they did is what the early records did, namely they reinforced a particular disposition. They nailed down as much a way of executing music and making the scores sound as they laid down a kind of conventional, canonic version of the buildings themselves. The two things, of course, are institutionally very tightly related, because it was in the concert halls where both the musicians were trained in order to execute music according to a certain ideal, and where the public developed its particular liking and preferences for execution. So that when we talk about the Toscanini Beethoven, the Bruno Walter Mahler, the Leinsdorf Bruckner, and so forth, and the rather dubious consequences of this sort of standardization, which found its most potent instrument in the recording industry, had to yield to both creatively for composers and with regard to the public to a far more flexible and adventurous disposition. So, in fact, it is the immediate post-war period that sees the greatest amount of acoustical, musical, compositional experimentation, for instance, in such institutions as the IRCAM in Paris, founded by Pierre Boulez, the German radio stations in the post-war years with their electronic studios. Even in the United States, in New Jersey, there were studios of the Bell Labs, which did study acoustics from a variety of interesting new points of view, all leading to, of course, industrial, or many of them, to industrial application. So what we have to see then, when we look at these halls, is not only, though for us it's the dominant subject, not only the issue of architecture of the building, but we have to see the actual use made of the buildings and the peculiar, specific, technical and cultural significance of music as equally at play in this work. After we've been initiated to the extraordinary shell structures worked out by Ove Arup for Utzon in Sydney, we won't be that surprised, as many were at the time, ignorant at that moment of such developments as those of the Sydney Concert Hall, to see these sketches, which were made by a composer, a mathematician, who worked in the studio of Corbusier, mainly in an engineering capacity. However, Yannis Xenakis, of Greek extraction, who came to France after the World War, Xenakis entered the studio of Le Corbusier with an engineer's training, but there soon began to intrigue Corbusier by a kind of thinking that tried to bridge the gap between certain mathematical phenomena of great complexity and physical reality of a very tangible kind. This had been something which fascinated and frustrated Le Corbusier for many years. You have to here think of the Corbusier of the modular, the Corbusier of that preoccupation with golden section, with mathematical paradigms that he attempted, with limited success, by the way, but he attempted to bring to a practical application within architecture, and thereby restore to architecture an inner cohesion and rationale that was increasingly challenged after the Second World War. Xenakis was also trained as a composer and grew into his own as a composer, really in the early 1960s, and after Corbusier's death, shifted his activity entirely to the field of music, where he worked with mainly strings and percussion. He worked with strings in the way that you see it here, that you see him here work with lines in these hyperboli and paraboli, in these surfaces that tent-like stretch through a double distortion and like helixes curve through space. So Xenakis defined clusters of sounds and indicated in glissandi, in a continuous change of pitch notated his scores in a fashion that is graphically very close to these sketches. The sketches here are synthetic. They are not the sketches made while the project was evolving, but rather summarize the solutions that had been considered. Up on the left is l'estomac, that is to say the stomach. The idea was to let people into a dark stomach, into a kind of vial, and to stretch over them, held up by a very few rigid masts, the meshes of cables, and cover the entire structure, which was, of course, constructed for temporary exhibition purposes, so as to create a kind of sculpture. I have to look for 1 second here. We see part of the inside, inside being worked on, the scaffolding in the middle under these stretched sail-like surfaces with lamps and loudspeakers mounted. Of course, the entire space was expected to turn dark for the performances, as indeed it was. There are a number of still shots that show the performances, projections of color from hidden light sources interacting with partly animated images that flit across and generically, although they remain elusive in many ways in their theme, have to do with the rise of life on Earth, with the transformation of an amorphous and monstrous nature into the refined and calculated results that only modern technology, and here again the Corbusier of the Age of the Enlightenment is speaking with a very loud voice through these complex curvatures of the pavilion that only modern technology would permit. As you can well imagine, this pavilion was an extraordinary and singular phenomenon at a world exhibition which was otherwise dominated by a kind of flat-footed, standardized modern architecture as Europe and the United States had come to accept it by 1958. The emblem of the exhibition was a model of an atomic nucleus. Of course, we are in the period of the atom, mainly known, of course, in its for its capacity to wreak havoc, and we are in a period of the Cold War where the atomic threat was everywhere. And so in the midst of this exotic, unexpected, astounding plant, like the spinnaker of a huge sailing vessel, with its surprisingly dark elusive dark interior, with fragments from a vision of life as it transformed itself on Earth, flitting past in a few minutes. The music composed by perhaps the best-known émigré French composer of the 20th century, written in the United States, Le Poème Électronique, that in its very name alluded to the electronics firm of the Philips that had sponsored this pavilion. Our third example is the Philharmonie, or the Philharmonic Hall in Berlin, by Hans Scharoun. Scharoun was ostracized from any public building projects during the Nazi period. He had, of course, very early on participated in major manifestations of modern architecture like the Weissenhof Siedlung in Stuttgart of 1927, with the only house that included, in fact, a prominent curvilinear element, the outside shape of a stairs going up to the second story, while otherwise, looking at Stuttgart, you will find a world that is fundamentally prismatic. So that first sign, perhaps, should prove prophetic. And indeed, Scharoun went on, both in the sector of housing and in public institutions like theatres, museums, industrial administration building, and, of course, most significantly, the Berlin Opera House, to give a second wind to a kind of geometry that had been pretty much ironed out of modern architecture by the time of the Second World War. Scharoun had also, immediately after the war, been the head of a commission set up to review the geography of Berlin, then over 80% devastated city by bombardments across the years. And in the course of that activity, developed a rather intriguing and very unexpected strategy for the city of Berlin, making deliberate use of large areas that had been devastated and had little prospect, or so it seemed, in the immediate post-war period, of ever being repopulated or reconstructed. So he planned large park-like areas that would, in a tentacular fashion, extend into the various segments of Berlin, and therefore allow for something that no other city in Europe would have been able to do, namely to distribute at key points within a sort of continuous park landscape important institutions. And one area singled out was really in the shadow. It was a dead area of town both before, and it remained so for very long until, and perhaps not least because it had been so fundamentally reevaluated by Scharoun, it became the area around the Potsdamer Platz and its extensions, that is the only part of Berlin, as you know, that has been completely built over in the last 15 years. Also years since the wall came down. What Scharoun planned was for a still undivided city, tacitly assuming, of course, the division into the various occupation sectors, but no physical impediment to traffic above and below ground. That set in shortly after the work on the Berlin Philharmonie had been completed in August 1961. The wall was constructed, condemning the Philharmonie to a border spot that hampered much of the development in its surroundings. And it is only now in a completely altered geography of Berlin that the hall truly regains its intended central focusing character, which works both day and night and was intended to do so. Perhaps one of the most striking features is the roofline, as you can see it here. And there are beautiful photographs at night. I'm sorry I can't show it to you because I have a night view, but that doesn't do the trick that I want you to recognize. But it is otherwise a very real one. And that is that you would approach from three sides in the time of Scharoun the Philharmonie by walking or driving along roads that lead through and under the trees of the Tiergarten, so-called, of a vast green area forested very densely in the middle of Berlin. So over the treetops, you would see this extraordinary broken curve And since it is very near at the same time above the trees at night, you would see it like the outline of a mountain. And indeed, on the edge, under that very, very modest little cornice, there are hidden fluorescent lights, which at night draw in a pure outline the mountain profile of the Philharmonie. And it is, of course, then inside that, in a sense, when the mountain is hollowed out, that we are seeing a kind of cavern, something that has a feeling of being completely detached from the outside. On the lower levels, you have the various foyers with a very interesting set of stairs and connectors, a very differentiated system, which at first sight might appear somewhat confusing, but is in actual fact extraordinarily efficient and enjoyable. People are moving up and down on these stairs, these landings, distribute themselves out around this whale of a space, of which one sees inside almost nothing but the underbelly or the outer hull, and then is released into this cavern as if spelunkers hit through narrow, tight passages where they practically would have to creep in this extraordinary inside space. Here you go up. Some of these stairs are brightly lit artificially at night or during the day. You come into the inside, which was characterized by Charoun himself as made up, what he says, of vineyard terraces. He uses landscape metaphors in order to describe this trough of a space around which, for the first time, after an early paper project of Walter Gropius in the 1920s for what was called a Universal Theater, or a universal theater, which could be universal in the sense, could be used for very different purposes, that also proposed one option of putting the orchestra roughly in the middle of a hall that could be moved in its segments mechanically, while here Charoun took seriously this idea that is both reminiscent of the tent. It's like a circus, where in fact in the circus, as you know, the best seats are right around the sawdust, right, where the elephants really do their job. The horses kick almost your ankles as they rush by, and the dancers can be seen from below. The trapeze artists fly right over your head, right? So this notion of the circus, where you're up to the action, and when you're further away, of course, it's the less desirable areas. In a normal concert hall, the situation is quite different. And here, the ambition was to, in a sense, create 2,300 seats that are all equally good, if not all identical, of course. So one does hear somewhat modified, in a somewhat distinctive and different way what one is hearing, but one cannot simply say that the lower ones are the good seats and the upper are less desirable, or some other such categorical distinction, but rather must recognize that it lies in the nature of such a concept that it is like a landscape. Everybody's front yard is their beloved front yard, and every view is different, every experience is a inflected or modified one. So Charoun was able to bring together in a very convincing and in the end also in a highly efficient fashion ideas that at first might strike you as far-fetched or inappropriate or outright willful. He clung to the notion, which we've seen before adumbrated in such drawings, as you Pharisees' vision of a metropolis mountains of buildings emerged. He clung to this notion of a mountain as a monument in the city. He gave it inside a character of a cavern and a tent, the tent carrying with it the notion of an event, of something very special, of great excitement, and finally the more permanent sense of climbing up the hillside and finding your particular perch on these vineyards, as he called them, to look down on the orchestra and an orchestra that is completely surrounded by the public and that therefore has a different relationship to the public. I mean, it goes to the point where, in fact, musicians had to learn to bow in more than one direction. You know, you can't, even at the end of the concert, you can't simply bow always in the same direction as you would have been induced to do in a conventional concert hall. What we're witnessing in all three of these, in very different form, certainly physically, and in a very different manner in terms of purpose and use, is, however, one common transformation in post-war architecture. And that transformation is so fundamental that I wanted you to look at these three buildings because we are now only living fully the consequences of this transformation away from an architecture in all circumstances and in every detail reduced to prismatic rectilinear volumes and lines, rather than an architecture capable to bend itself, to extend, or to draw together, to rise up or to deflate, to cut deep or to expand wide beyond the confines of a rectilinear geometry. The rectilinear geometry, of course, puts forward its authoritarian claim of a system that will have an answer to any problems, provided the problems can be defined within that system. Whereas this architecture is based on what one could call perhaps a polar opposite principle, the principle being that what happens, what occurs in a particular activity, the nature of that activity, both in its physical and in its imaginative dimensions, will lead to a certain kind of architecture whose forms cannot be derived categorically from a fixed repertoire. So it is significant that Charoun, when he gave a brief description of the project first entered in the competition in 1955, he started out with an observation which is both disarmingly simple and, in the minds of many, inappropriate for a concert hall. He said, whenever a street musician starts playing, people form an approximate circle around him or her. So he took the most primitive form of music making that has this magnetic capacity of drawing people together, but not relegating to the one side and the musician in a professional role to the other side, which would be the classic result of the conventional concert hall. So he wanted to go back to a ritual, atavistic role of music, which just changes your pace as you walk along on the sidewalk, as maybe with one ear only you listen to some fiddler at the corner, or you stop for a moment and listen to the line spun by a saxophonist on the landing as you go down to the subway. And then people have a tendency to cluster, immediately suggesting that music is something which creates a kind of community. And that effect should never be allowed to be completely cut short and split up between a professional musician on the stage and an admission-paying audience on the other side, down, pinned into their seats. But even on the level of some of the most complex and sophisticated music making, that beginning ought to be recalled, and that particular function of music in society should not go unrecognized. So this is the other paradigm from which so much else flows in the later 20th century.